Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Cotterman. I am the Associate Artistic Director. I am joined by a table full of wonderful people who are involved in our upcoming production of Macbeth. So I'm just going to have everyone go around the table, starting with Mr. Ben Fisler to my right.
Well, I'm Ben Fisler. I'm playing Macbeth.
I am Jared Michael Swain. I'm playing King Duncan and Seward and Apparition One and Lord.
I'm Tegan Williams, and I'm playing Macduff.
I'm Kevin Finkelstein. I directed the show.
I'm Valerie Dowdle. I'm playing Lady Macbeth.
Now, I have to interject because Duncan is an actual relative of mine. We were talking about this before we started recording.
I have
a personal connection to this play. Malcolm is a grandfather, a great-grandfather of mine. And so Malcolm and Duncan, I'm related to. So...
Sorry.
Yeah, you already lost this part of the interview.
Yeah. And I'm also related to King John, so all of the kings of the summer are relatives of mine. So let's just jump right in. Macbeth is... I've always really liked Macbeth because I feel like it's one of Shakespeare's tightest plays. There's like no B... We were talking about this. Mm-hmm. There's no B plots. Like, the porter is the B plot, and it's one scene, which is odd for Shakespeare because he's usually...
Yeah, he gets a little bit too... I wouldn't say too, but he gets... He doesn't mind taking a separate track and just exploring a totally different story, which can be really fun, or if it's a weak one, can kind of get in the way. But Macbeth does not suffer from that at all.
So how's that been working on that, on something like that? It just has that... It's really driven, I feel like, as a play. It just starts and it's like a roller coaster, right? Do you guys feel that way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely do. Especially as soon as the witches come in, or... Yeah, we'll just say as soon as the witches come in, it just takes off. It just takes off.
Yeah, it's a ride. And it's... So... I don't know. Yeah, this is a dumb question, but, like, it's the question you always ask the director. It's like, what's your vision of the play? Like, I don't know, like, what drew you to this play? What has drawn you to it now that you've started doing it?
Well, one of the things that's most interesting is the historical context of Macbeth, right? And writing this for King James I and recognizing that James was a huge fan of witchcraft, and so he wrote it, he took Hollinshed's The Witches and put them into the show to appease King James and kind of say, hey, look, there's something neat going on here. So it is a little bit of the B arc, the witch's story, in parts, is very separate from the rest of the world and what happens with the rest of the world.
Right.
True. Our job, what we have focused on, is making that distinction very, very clear. That there are these otherworldly, supernatural creatures, and then there are the humans that sort of do these things and have these interactions.
Mm-hmm.
The question, one of the questions raised in the script, and I talk about this a little bit in the director's notes, is whether the witches caused the action, whether the action was always going to happen, or it's some combination of the two. And I think we've tried very hard to not make a choice there, but let the audience walk away with what they're thinking about, whether this is fate or whether this is the result of several sets of actions.
Right. And for those who don't know, to follow up on what Kevin was just saying, so Queen Elizabeth died, King James I had the best claim on the throne, he was Scottish, he was King James VI, I think, of Scotland, and so he became James I of England, and he was... Like Kevin said, a big fan of witchcraft. And Banquo was also one of his relatives, I think, right?
He was. He was.
So,
there's a lot of... Shakespeare wove a lot of James's life into this play to impress the new king.
Mm-hmm. And he's the King James of the King James Bible, which some people think Shakespeare wrote. Or translated, you know.
Oh, it's not that good.
The juicy parts. Like, I don't know. Ben, what do you think? How much is... Macbeth doing, you know, what is fate? What is Macbeth doing this on his own? And Valerie, obviously, I'm going to ask you the same question.
From the global perspective, I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. But from the personal perspective, I think it's very clear that Macbeth has been thinking about his legacy for a long time. And then along come these weird sisters, these ladies in the middle of nowhere who say, hey, how you doing? Thane of Glamis. Yeah, I know. That's next. Right. My dad just died. Whatever. And Thane of Cawdor. What? And King. Huh. And then it becomes this sort of, everything just seems to be lining up for him. Of course he's going to be king. And then that, of course, creates the conundrum of the play, which is that once I am king, now I have to deal with the fact that there's this threat to the very legacy of being king. Because the very same people who told me everything is going to work out for you also told me everything is going to work out for Banquo, and what are you going to, you know, so now it's like, what am I going to do?
And then everything's going to fall apart.
And then everything's, so at some point, everything's going to fall apart for me because Banquo's kids are going to be the king. Mm-hmm. They're going to be the line of kings. So, yeah, it you're putting it in the context of King James and just thinking, you know, Shakespeare basically saying to the actor playing Macbeth, hey, you're going to get everything. But then it's all going to go to this other guy. Or at least to his great, 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 great grandson.
So is it worth it then?
Oh. And I think that's the conundrum of Macbeth, is that he's constantly asking himself before he does it, after he does it, after he's already done it, is it worth it? And there are times when he concludes, no, it's not worth it. We're not doing this. And then there are times when he says, okay, honey, we'll do it. And then there are times when he says, I wish I hadn't. And then there are times when he says, well, I've already done this, this, and this, so I might as well do this other stuff. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite lines in the play is, I am stepped in blood so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as going over. Mm-hmm. So he's literally saying, I'm already covered in blood, so I could turn around, but I'm going to be wading through the same river as if I just kept going, so I might as well just keep going.
that's a logical fallacy. But that's fine.
Tell us more about logical fallacies, Lady Macbeth.
I won't. Just to answer kind of the same thing, I agree with you, Ben. It's interesting to me that Lady Macbeth never, from what we see in the play, actually experiences anything supernatural. Mm. So she just takes her husband at his word and is all too happy, I think, on the slightest impetus to move forward with this pretty insane plot. So I think it would have been, it could have been, you know, some kids he stumbled across in the forest or like just a deer like absolutely anything. We were ready to kill Duncan and move forward and claim what we saw as our rightful spot.
Right.
And that's just how it happened to go.
Duncan. Hey. Duncan. Where do you fit into all this? Oh, how do you feel?
Where do I fit into all of this? Well, I'm only here for a little bit and then I'm gone. But no, seriously. We actually had an interesting conversation about Duncan and where he fits in all of this in terms of, you know, Duncan is not... or was not, excuse me, a really good decision maker as a king. I think he really enjoyed the pomp and circumstance of it all and really the showmanship of it. Mm-hmm. When it came to making very good military or even strategical decisions for his kingdom, that was not his strong suit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when Macbeth comes in and says, well, when the witches come in and tell Macbeth, you know, this is your next step in your destiny, it's really all form-fitting. And that also drags the question of, was this predetermined fate or was this, you know, something that the witches just conjured up, or was this action A going to action B to action C and this, that, and the fourth? So yeah, King Duncan's position is very interesting. However, I'm enjoying all the pomp and circumstance when I'm up on stage.
You're really good at it.
There's always a moment in one of the scenes, I believe it's act one, scene six, where I'm about to come in, and then there's a fanfare, and I'm always, no matter what, I'm always like, whoo, right before I say my line. Every time. I'm like,
it feels good to have a fanfare.
Like, it kind of feels good. I'm not going to lie about it.
One of the other things that we've done with Duncan in this idea of setting up whether this is going to happen anyway or choices, Jared's playing Duncan as a very old king who could die at any day. Mm-hmm. And so the prophecy could be fulfilled if he dies before naming an heir. Macbeth could become king.
But then he does.
But then, right.
I actually think
that moment has really evolved. I love the way that moment has evolved because it's perfect.
It rips his heart out.
I know. I'm just like, yeah.
That moment is actually my...
I had to go and make Malcolm.
Sorry, buddy.
tell our audience what moment you're talking about.
Thank you.
So,
ask the same question.
So this is the moment. <host. laughs> This is the moment somewhere in the beginning of the play where Macbeth has just came back and says, "I have taken care of this armor for you. And right. Duncan's like, thank you so much, my now Thane of Cawdor. You mm-hmm. shall have all the graces, you shall have all the glory. And by the way, before we move on, Malcolm's going to be king after me.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Because it's all set up like Macbeth is going to get everything, including the throne. Yeah. And then to have him turn around and give it to his son Malcolm, I think that's the last switch for Macbeth.
Yeah.
It really fuels him to make the decisions that he makes.
But it's also about hearing what you want to hear in that moment, right? Macbeth hears what he wants to hear. There's nothing that Duncan says that's inwardly or outwardly, I'm promising you the moon, and then I'm taking it all away from you. I think it's more about what Macbeth wants to hear in that moment. Oh, I'm going to have all this. I'm going to have all... What do you mean that Malcolm is going to be king after you? Yeah. And so it's kind of reaching into the heart, reaching into the chest, taking out the heart, throwing it on the ground, and then a couple of seconds later spitting on it.
Did Scotland not have primogeniture as it's like... Which is, means your eldest son inherits
Not traditionally. For those at home. That's the other thing is that, yeah...
Because he should have expected Malcolm was going to be the king.
Right, but that's not the case. And I think that's interesting because it almost derails the Scottish tradition right in front of him. I mean, I should be better educated on this, but I know that primogeniture was not necessarily a part of Scottish tradition because anything could technically become a king.
Stay tuned for the King John edition where we will talk a lot about primogeniture.
Because Malcolm, in the historical world, in the events of... the start of the play, Malcolm is 9. Right? So there's already a sense of like, it's not just you're going to give it to your kid. You're going to give it to your 9-year-old.
Yikes.
Aww.
It's a slap in the face.
Tegan, we've left you out so far. So you play Macduff, who has like one of the great emotional journeys in the play.
Yeah.
How's that been for you?
So it's really interesting because I feel like a lot of Macduff's journey is like his world crashing around. So first of all, the battle at the beginning where Macduff and Banquo come back as heroes is at Fife, and that's where Macduff lives. So I've interpreted that as to be like I've been in a siege and then Macbeth lifted and I'm like, great, I'm going to his house, this is going to be wonderful, like this is going to be great. And then the king dies, and all my language indicates to me that, you know, there are people who are loyal to a throne and loyal to a family. So Macduff is loyal to a family. So when Duncan dies, like, everything changes. Like, where do I stand? What's happening? Like, who can I trust? What's going on? So...
all under the cover of this love for country.
Yeah. So, like, Macduff loves his country, but I think above that... it's just like a big old ball of confusion. So Macduff takes himself out of the situation, sees his country going completely downhill, tries to recruit Malcolm to the side. Malcolm comes, and then his family is killed. And it's just terrible and tragic. And it's been wonderful and challenging and exciting.
Can I ask? This is the first time I'm a total newcomer to this play, which is has been really, really fun for me. And Macduff was the most surprising character for me. Do you think he's to blame for fleeing to England and leaving his family?
I don't. Given the options, Macduff said, I think the way I've interpreted it, Macduff had a choice to stay and possibly be killed and put his family in danger, or leave and hopefully nobody would notice.
Yeah, he could reasonably expect, if I flee the country, my children won't be slaughtered.
Like, well, I like, who thinks that, like, oh, I'm like, I'm the one in danger. I was close to close to the family. My family just got over a siege. What am I going to do? Go home and then there's going to be a battle and they're all going to die or be in siege again. So what can I do to prevent the situation? I'm going to go to England. Because who thinks that I'm going to leave and then someone's going to attack your family?
Yeah.
Like,
that was out of left field there, honey.
Yeah.
Well, the Weird Sisters said, beware Macduff.
But it's such a tactical failure. Macduff could not have done anything better to light a fire under Macduff than to make this action,
right? Yeah, like, the type of character Macduff is, it's like... action. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing indicates that he sits and thinks about anything. Mm. It's like, this is my gut reaction, I'm going to do it. So, like, in the scene where you find out that Macduff's family is killed, or Macduff finds out, like, I have maybe, I don't know, 20 lines of mourning, and then I'm I'm going to kill this guy. Yeah. Like, I'm going to kill him right now. And the way we've staged it is, like, I would run out and walk to Scotland and kill him with my bare hands if someone didn't stop me. And I just think it's, like, a miscalculation.
Mm-hmm. On Macbeth's part. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think Macbeth learns the wrong lessons throughout the course of the action. I mean, he does. Really? Because clearly. He's much more thoughtful at the beginning of the play. He has a lot more lines at the beginning of the play. The later you get into it, the more he's like, all right, be it thought and done. This is what I'm going to do. And even like right before he makes the decision to order the death of Macduff's entire family, he says, he basically chastises himself for not acting fast enough. Like, as if that's the problem.
it's interesting because I'm not sure. I think he sort of maintains a thoughtfulness. And I mean, I think Macbeth has one of the great speeches in Shakespeare, which is the tomorrow speech, which I think is the perfect example of why I like this play a lot. And when I was saying it's very concise, is that that's the kind of thing Hamlet would take 60 lines to say. Like what Macbeth says in that speech in what, 8 lines, 9 lines would take another character in Shakespeare, five times as long to say.
Macbeth is more mature.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. And it's
in a hurry.
Yeah.
The speech begins with I don't have time.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of time. He basically she should have died hereafter because there would have been time for such a word.
Yeah.
Then he says, "So this is what I have time for. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow." And then he does that speech and then he's like, "Okay, back to other stuff."
I mean, that's a very powerful realization.
It is.
It's a powerful thing that he's expressing is that, it's like existential dread.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Right? I mean, wow.
Yeah.
It's a tale told by an idiot.
It's got sound and fury, but signifies nothing.
So the fact that Valerie isn't read it or didn't read it before is sort of amazing because this is, I think, one of the most well-known, well-read Shakespeare plays. Because
it's just a gap in my knowledge.
Yeah, it's like me and Catcher in the Rye.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, I know.
You can't read it now.
I know, I'm too old.
You'll hate it.
I'm too old. Yeah. I missed it in high school, and now I'm just too old. Yeah, I read Macbeth first in probably like 10th grade, and I know it's in a lot of high school curricula. So what is, Kevin and anybody else that, please jump in with this too, because I'm interested in we have this luxury with King John, I feel like, which is nobody's ever read it. Nobody's ever seen it. Hasn't been done in this town since 1782. So it's a brand new play essentially. But Macbeth is something a lot of people know, because there's been very famous film adaptations of it. One recent, everybody's read it. Not everybody, but a lot of people have read it. So there's a lot of baggage maybe that people bring.
Sure.
What do you guys do to sort of to circumvent that or to keep it fresh?
So one of the things any actor in the show will tell you, I repeat constantly, is that we are all storytellers, right? And the story that the 14 actors in the show are telling will never be told again, ever.
Yeah.
It will be done differently by other people in other theaters with other focuses. But our show, for every audience member that comes in here, whether they've seen Macbeth 30 times or they've never read it, they have never seen this production. And so for us, it's important to find the truth within the script. All of it is there. It's one of the wonderful things about Shakespeare. It's all on the page, right? You don't need to add in all of these, I think he was this is nothing against anybody, but he was a war hero, or he lost a leg in the... No, none of that is necessary because it detracts from the beautiful story that's already there. And too many productions, I think, try and do too much away from the text that's there. One of the wonderful things about Baltimore Shakespeare is that it's about the text.
Yeah, I always tell people Shakespeare is a smarter person than you. So Shakespeare is a better writer than me. So I'm just going to trust him and do what he wrote for me.
For me, it's all about, making discoveries, trying to find yourself in the character. Because clearly, as Kevin said, no one's going to play Macduff the way I play Macduff. They might make similar choices, but they're not the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they haven't had the same experiences or, like, just the same, like, little things that I find. Like, for example, I think that if Macduff, you met him as, like, a regular person and you were walking down the street with him, he'd like to tell jokes. Like, he tries to tell jokes with the porter.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. But you never see Macduff just chilling. And Kevin told me a lot to look at how, like, the wife and Macduff's son interact. Because, like, your kids are little versions of you. And clearly the son is not, like, the mom. So mm-hmm. it has to be, like, the dad. So it's just, like, who else is going to think about that? I'm like, oh, so...
Yeah, we rarely get to see Shakespeare's, like, tragic and historic characters, like, at a good time.
Yeah,
like, we don't meet Juliet on her birthday party when she gets her pony.
I get three lines to tell people, and maybe, like, a little bit with Macbeth uh-huh. when I come in. I'm like, oh, I just have this duty, like...
Yep.
Yeah. It's like we're meeting everybody at the worst moments
of
their lives.
Yeah.
We get a tiny little intro into their lives before the start of the play, mm-hmm. and then the events of the play overtake
mm-hmm.
and change them.
For me, I'm also a newcomer with Macbeth. I've read it.
Yeah.
Definitely read it probably about maybe three times, but I've never performed Macbeth. I never even performed Shakespeare on stage, to be honest with you.
You're really good with the language.
wait, but yeah. That's where I was going, though, because... At least with this play and approaching Shakespeare on stage for the first time, it was really interesting to discover all of my characters within the verse. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to see, like, their thought process form with the meter and everything. Yeah. I'm like, wow.
It's great, isn't it?
It is great. And I'm like, it's beautiful. Sometimes it's very, I'm not tragic is not the word, but sometimes when I'm reading Stuart, I'm like, this is very engaging. This is very, like... passionate and
I think
heartfelt.
It's visceral with the C word.
It's very visceral. Like the speech that I have before I say advance the war, mm-hmm. it's that well with due decision make us know what we shall say we have and what we hope. Every time I say it,
gorgeous.
And I say it in my natural voice, I'm not putting no voice in it. I'm just like, I'm ready for something to go mm-hmm. down right now. I'm ready for mm-hmm. everything. Hit me with it.
Yeah, and your observation that comes from, like, what you're finding on the page
right.
is just great. I mean, he gives you so much to work with. Yeah. I think that's what's so great about Shakespeare yeah. is that it's all there.
Exactly.
The tool, you know, I tell my actors, like, you know, Shakespeare works on, like, a subatomic level, and you need to, like, you need to split those atoms to get all those particles out and get all the energy out.
And as long as you break it down and respect it, mm-hmm. you'll find it.
Yeah. You keep fighting it.
Yeah, which was very liberating for me approaching it for the first time.
Well, that's awesome. That's really good to hear.
I think that also explains why that fanfare feels so right to yes, you.
Exactly.
Da, 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 da.
I just got to remember that it's got to be there. Every single
time. I'm behind him. He's constantly surprised. He, like, takes his breath to speak, and then the fanfare happens. He's like, right, I am the king. Right.
Because it doesn't happen anywhere else, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
Well, because you get killed, like, a scene later.
I do.
Yeah.
I really do. I don't think... So, we just did costumes I'm sorry if I'm rambling, but we just did costumes a couple of days ago. And we're figuring out what to do with Duncan. You know, he gets, like, the red robe and then the cape. And then me and Sandra? Sarah?
Kendra.
Kendra. I knew it was Kendra, but me and Kendra were... trying to figure out, okay, what do we do with the cape, and then how are the boots going to fit? And then she pulls out the crown.
Oh, that crown.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is about the crown, and when I put it on, it's just a thing of like,
Yeah.
You really don't want to...
Does yours fit?
Oh, it does. It's beautiful
It does, it's beautiful, but like, one of the things that I'm trying to avoid doing is putting it off to the side of my head.
Oh, yeah. Very comfortable.
Oh, no. Like, I walked, the first scene, I walked out with it on the side of my head, and I had this little stroll going. I'm like, this ain't Duncan. This is Jared wearing a crown and being stupid. What are you doing? What are you doing? Check yourself and get back into play.
My crown, in Winter's Tale, it never fit me. I have a big head, so it was always hard to find a crown that fit me. So glad yours fits.
Side note, I wear Ben's crown as Apparition 3, and it is so uncomfortable when it doesn't fit you. I'm just like, it's all the way back, and I'm like, it's supposed to be here, and then it just falls off. I'm just like...
Oh, that's what we were doing when we did Richard III, and we had to take the guy who was playing Edward. His head was smaller than mine, and the crown was just falling over. Oh. I felt so bad for him.
I think, yeah, that's at. Not to get too off track, but I have the same crown problem. Very large head, and wow, that's it hurts. Mm-hmm. I've been really discovering something in Lady Macbeth. There's a lot in this play about borrowed robes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's mentioned like 4 or 5 times about people putting on ill-fitting garments that don't quite fit. Mm-hmm. And to me, as soon as I put that crown on, I was like, well, this is an example of that.
Ill-fitting
garments. Exactly. It's like they think this is destiny, this is fate, it has to happen, they're going to be king and queen. And as soon as it happens, it's like... Ooh, yeah, don't like it. That hurts.
There's a reason the crown doesn't fit.
Yeah. Lady Duncan had a small head.
So there's a great scene where Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are out there, and Macbeth is doing most of the talking, and Val's got the crown on, and she will take the crown off for a little while, and then she'll put it back on, and then she'll take it off again. And I get that maybe there's an actor thing of, like, it's uncomfortable, but for us as the audience, it reads like... I'm having indecisiveness, I'm having issues with this, I don't feel comfortable assuming the role that I've stepped into, sort of thing. And so it's one of those scenarios where nobody would have necessarily said, let's look at this as a character mm-hmm. choice, but given how the crowns are working, it's coming across really strongly.
Yeah. Cool. I never would have thought of that if the crown was perfect.
So I know you guys have been rehearsing all day, so I'm catching them at the end of their rehearsal, very long day. So, last thoughts. I don't know. Let's go around and I don't know. What's a good dumb generic question? What can the audience take away from this? What would you like audiences to, I don't know, think of a better question. what do you want people to take away, I guess? Or what excites you about what you're doing?
Ooh, I can answer this one. Macbeth is considered a tragedy through and through. But I can see everyone around me, have discovered so many humorous moments in it. So I really hope that the audience will come in not ready to pull out their handkerchiefs and sob, but ready to discover the irony and the uncomfortable awkwardness of it all, and just experience the story with us for both the happy parts and the... sad parts.
Hey, Ben?
Seriously, what Val said. As an actor, I think I've just done a lot more comedy. And so finding funny moments in such a bloody, delicious, I mean, deliciously bloody play. I mean, there's so many when there's not blood on stage, we're talking about blood. Yeah. And when we're not talking about blood, there's blood on our hands or there's blood on our face. And it's just, that stuff is wonderful. And there's so much delicious, just pathos and just moments of wonderful moments where you can just sit there and go, oh man, like if I were, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah. That's not going to work out, dude. Like, you know, just the whole thing with, like, because just the arrogance with which Macbeth just keeps repeating, I cannot fall until the forest moves to my castle, to the hill that my castle is on. Ha! Up yours.
Yeah.
And we're all sitting there going, it's not what that means, Mac. It's not what that means. And hopefully there's a lot of pleasure to be found in that kind of, as an audience, we know things that the actors don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do find Macbeth to be one of the more accessible of Shakespeare's plays. So I'm really interested for the audience to come in and just watch how we handle it. Because there is a special way that we're handling it. And I think Val hit it on the head when she said, it is a tragedy, but we kind of haven't been leaning into that for some reason. Like, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of lightness, but definitely when we hit those, you know, bloody moments, mm-hmm. there is something that comes out of it. So I think that the audience is really going to have a good time, and hopefully that they understand it. Because me, personally, at least people who I've told to see the show, they don't. understand Shakespeare that well, but I'm like, you're going to get it.
It's because they've never seen it done right.
That's what I say.
Or because they read it. And Shakespeare's not exactly meant to be read.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they were taught in high school by somebody who couldn't be bothered.
Yeah. I don't know. They've said why I should come see this show. I mean, I'm most excited for people to react to the witches. I know that's not my part. But
may I? Yeah. The fights are crazy good.
But actually.
Crazy good.
But actually.
That's Tegan Williams.
Yeah. This one.
Yeah, me.
And miraculously, like, everyone who is in a fight scene is really good at fighting. I don't know if maybe...
That was fortunate.
Yeah, that was fortunate. Yeah, because you don't know us.
So a couple of things. I think we haven't really played, as Jared talked about, the heaviness because we haven't made... We're not telling the audience if Macbeth is a protagonist or an antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
That is their choice. And a lot of that will depend on who you are as a person. The experiences that you bring into the space, that will impact how you view Macbeth over this. Is he an opportunistic, you know, grabbing a greed, or is he a victim of circumstance?
Mm.
Or is he somewhere in the middle? I'm not making that decision. I don't want to make that decision.
I don't think Shakespeare did either.
I think he purposely
does.
Way that he purposely mangles time in this play so that the 17 years that actually passed, you have no idea in the text that that's the truth.
Yeah.
He does a lot of that. In scene two and the last scene in the play.
Wait. Macbeth and Lady are king and queen for 17 years?
They actually are. When I was talking with Jessica Clark, our dramaturg, I think it's closer to 10 or 11 years that they have that they're king and queen.
Yeah.
Because think about it, a 9-year-old Malcolm wouldn't come all the way back to Scotland for the war.
Right. And so there's also questions about what Malcolm was doing in England. Is he training? Trying to get to a place where people will respect and listen to him as an adult? And he's 26 by the time he leaves.
Shakespeare could not care less about the Eumenides.
This is true. He came pretty far from the Greeks.
Give me my crown.
I think the reason to come see this show in this space, no matter how many times you've seen Macbeth before, every director's concept is shaped, whether or not they'll admit it, by the space that they're performing in. 100%. I have never worked, I've never directed a show in this space before. And I have just had so much fun trying to find and play with all of the nooks, crannies, and the different things that you can do here. I have the great fortune of having seen several shows here, but never having directed. So I've got all these different ideas about ways that I'm told the space has never been used. That's wonderful. That's great. We want more of that. You don't want people to walk into a space and think, I know what I'm going to see.
Mm.
You want them to think, I'm going to see a good show. I know I'm going to get my money's worth. I know I'm going to be challenged. But you don't want them to know what they're going to see. That defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
And I think people coming to see Macbeth are going to see something in the space that they have not seen before.
I agree.
Including bagpipes.
Including bagpipes.
So on that note, Macbeth opens soon, June 29th, correct? Mm-hmm. And we run 4 weekends, so all that information is online, BaltimoreShakespeareFactory.org. Tickets are on sale. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. I saw the last 5 minutes today. It looked really cool. So I've been shirking my artistic duties and haven't been at rehearsals, but I trust you guys. So yeah, thanks so much for joining me at the end of your long day.
Thank you.
And it was great talking to you, and I'm really looking forward to the show.
Yeah.
So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll catch you around at the show.